This is Brian Forster, and welcome to the Active Investor Podcast, our monthly look at asset classes and investment styles that have the potential for delivering alpha. And we also get a chance to hear how some of our investment leaders at Lord Abbett are looking at opportunities today. And for this episode, we are back to talking about equities, and more specifically, thinking from a global perspective about where some of the great themes are today, as well as some of the best companies in the world. And we have exactly the right guest for that discussion today in Ryan Howard, the lead portfolio manager on Lord Abbett's top-ranked global equity strategy, and also a portfolio manager for our U.S. equity income portfolio and our international value portfolio. So welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
So Ryan's background and his CV can be covered pretty quickly, as he has spent his entire 21-year career here at Lord Abbett, starting as a research analyst in the international equity area and then progressively moving into portfolio management on the equities team. He's a CFA charter holder and also has an MBA from NYU. And I think I'd most notably say that he has a passion for understanding great businesses and what makes them tick. And I guess that brings me to my first question for you, Ryan. How did you get started in investing? What drew you to wanting to be in this area of finance? Any interesting anecdotes from your personal history to connect the dots?
Yeah, of course. So while there are many people in our industry, many very good people in our industry that have taken sort of long and circuitous routes to their place in the industry, I'm not one of those people. I've been attracted to finance most of my life. One of my first memories of being intrigued by finance was as an elementary schooler when a friend of mine received a bond from his grandparents for Christmas. And he was describing to me what this thing was, and I was absolutely enamored by the compounding element of it. The idea that you could buy something that will pay you more money. In my 9-year-old brain, it was like using your wish to wish for more wishes. I was amazed that you could do this. So following that, I spent the next 6 months begging my dad to open up a savings account for me so I could replicate this strategy. I had a piggy bank full of dollar bills that were just sitting there. So I was convinced in my mind that I was missing out. Mm-hmm. He finally took me to the bank and we opened up an account. And my second lesson in finance was savings deposits and CDs are a very painful way to grow your wealth. Yeah. So fast forward to high school, economics was offered as an elective, which I took. I absolutely loved it. I declared as an economics major even before I got to university campus. In that period, I was attracted quite a bit to macro. So some of my favorite coursework was things like international macro and money and banking. I graduated and was fortunate enough to find a job here at Lord Abbett just as the international equity group was commencing. It was a really fun time to be in international. Emerging markets were booming. Jim O'Neill from Goldman had just coined the term BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And this all fit very nicely into my macro leanings. These were large domestic markets that were driven by rising consumption and a growing middle class. And it wasn't until later in my career with a pivot back to developed markets when I really began to see microeconomics and the analysis of a company's market position and industry structure as the pure faith and the more efficacious analysis. Reading and listening to people like Michael Mauboussin, Pat Dorsey, and creating shareholder value by Alfred Rappaport that really helped me solidify that as a key focus of mine in investments going forward. Maybe more than you wanted to know, but that's a little bit on my journey through finance and economics.
Interesting. So from sort of trading, the excitement of trading savings bonds up to BRICS, up to today, good stuff. So when you think about your 21 years at Lord Abbett and kind of all that's changed in the financial world during that time, and you think about like the rise of indexing, the massive boom in tech stocks and technology in our lives, which has now become really known by the massive kind of mega cap names, you know, we've seen some really big changes in how investors look at the stock market. At the same time, non-US stocks and value stocks were really left behind between 2009 all the way into like 2022. And now we seem to be in a new environment for stocks with, you know, higher interest rates, still some meaningful inflation and concern over the massive influence of those mega cap stocks. So I guess my question for you is, how do you see the world as an equity investor with that backdrop?
So first of all, we're constructive on the outlook for equities at large. We see a resilient global economy with data which on the margin seems to be getting, if anything, better. A Fed which looks to be on hold at worst and cutting at best. And you put all that together and the outlook for corporate earnings is strong. So on the last point, I think, is the key one, and you mentioned the ups and downs of certain parts of the equity market over the years, and a lot certainly has changed, but there's one constant, and that's the expectations for earnings and cash flow drive stocks. And I think it might be worth getting a little bit more into the weeds here as to how we think about that, and that'll lead us to, you know, how we're thinking about positioning in the current market. So as you think about the earnings and cash flow profile of a business, I would look at it along three dimensions. And, you know, the first and most intuitive is the rate of growth of your earnings and cash flow.
Right.
And that's a pretty intuitive concept for most people. The faster you can grow your earnings and cash flow, the more valuable a business should be. And of course, that's true. But there are two other ones that are equally as important. You know, the second is the predictability of that stream of earnings and cash flow. So an entrenched software business, which is growing at 10%, will be valued quite differently than an airline growing at 10% because of the predictability and believability and durability of that stream of cash flows. And then lastly, how much capital needs to be invested to generate that growth in earnings and cash flow. So is the business capital efficient and can they grow by investing a limited amount of capital, or do they have to invest a lot to generate that similar stream of earnings and cash flow?
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we think about the backdrop for investing today in a higher interest rate world, that last one is a big part of it. So we've been through this period of ultra loose monetary policy, and capital was very cheap and very plentiful, and there was a proliferation of business models which were quite dependent on a constant need for external financing, and that was okay in that environment because it was readily available. In a higher rate world, where capital is a little tighter, we think you need to be looking for businesses which can first and foremost generate cash internally to fund their growth ambitions, and secondly, businesses which can reinvest that internally generated cash flow at a high rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
And that over the long run is going to drive better growth at those businesses, and they'll be more richly rewarded.
Yeah. Interesting. So another question I think that comes up when you hear about a global equity strategy, you know, it's something along the lines of, so Ryan, what are your favorite regions or markets right now, or how are you tilted to areas like India or EM, or aren't you concerned about slower growth in other regions, or is it time to lighten up on the US? Those types of questions. Now, I know you think a lot about all of those topics and probably a lot more, but is that the main driver of how you think about investing around the world?
We do, of course, follow the global economic data, and we understand how various markets are performing and what's driving that market performance, but it's not really the primary way we make decisions. In the global equity strategy, we're primarily investing in developed market multinational businesses So a bottom-up style, which is looking for businesses with strong market positions, sustainable competitive advantages, is really a better fit for the strategy versus a top-down allocation strategy. And I'll give you some examples and some numbers, which I hope will shed some light on this concept. The average company in our portfolio derives about 42% of its revenue outside of its country of listing. And if you exclude the U.S. companies and only look at the non-U.S. businesses we own, that number jumps to 58% of revenue coming from outside the country's listing. So these businesses are not always tied to the economic fortunes of their home market. They're very much global businesses for the most part. And Novo Nordisk is a great example of this. So it's a Danish pharmaceutical company and the maker of Ozempic, which most people
never heard of it.
Which most people will be familiar with. We invested in the company because we see an evolving duopoly in the fast-growing market for obesity therapeutics. The business has a mountain of corporate intellectual property that will allow them to retain a cutting edge in that market and meaningful production capacity and distribution to commercialize that opportunity. We didn't allocate to Novo because of the European economy or the European market. Another great example is Nintendo. So we believe Nintendo is the best gaming business on the planet. They have a well-invested, fully owned content library that continues to get better as they enhance it through movies and theme parks, things like the Mario Brothers movie, which drove software title sales for the business. They have an engaged audience of 130 million Nintendo Switch users, and they'll be transitioning that audience to the Switch 2. So a nice upcoming product cycle within the next 12 months. It wasn't because of the Japanese economy or the Japanese market that attracted us to Nintendo. It was the company's market position and the prospects for its business.
I guess it's really just about finding the best businesses anywhere, right? So following on with that thought, let's talk a little more specifics then on what you look for across really some very different types of businesses. You just mentioned a few companies that are great in their own right, but in very different industries, they do very different things. You know, some could be classified as maybe high innovation growth, others as value stocks, you know, some in the US, some in Europe, Asia, et cetera. You know, one way, I guess, maybe to think about it is there's just a lot you don't own in your portfolios as well, right? So again, given all the differences there, can you give a quick overview on kind of what you think are the key commonalities across the 80 or so stocks that you do buy?
Yes, of course. The first thing we look for in any business, irrespective of what part of the market it's coming from, whether it's domestic, international, growth, or value, is one of three forms of sustainable competitive advantage. And that's either a consumer advantage, a producer advantage, or a network advantage. And maybe before we get into the details of what each of those are, maybe just a word on why it's important. So, you know, as we're all taught in our, you know, finance 101 classes, high returns on capital reinvested drives your growth over a longer period of time. We're also taught in those same classes that high returns on capital in excess of your cost of capital can't be sustained because competition will come in and bid those returns down to lower levels.
Right.
And it's the last part that I would sort of beg to differ with. In practice, we can and do find businesses which are able to sustain high rates of return for a number of cycles, if not more. And they're usually able to retain it because they have one of these three forms of competitive advantage. So a consumer advantage, there's something special about the product. This is something that the consumer struggles to find elsewhere in a competing product or that new entrants really struggle to replicate. It could be a trusted brand, a unique patented feature, something the consumer is willing to pay up for.
Mm-hmm.
So a good example here is LVMH. Brian, you and I could start a handbag company tomorrow. It wouldn't be Vuitton. There's unique brand equity. There's a unique heritage there that it is very challenging for all but a handful of companies to replicate. And that advantage is manifests itself in pricing power, and you have a business that can price in excess of most competitors.
Right.
So that's what drives its sustained high return is a high margin structure through time that can't be competed away. The second advantage is a producer advantage, and here it's not the product that's special; it's the way it's produced that's hard to replicate. Mm. So these are generally economies of scale or economies of scope businesses. And you could think of an example like Costco. There's nothing really special about the product. The customer doesn't really care where they get their strawberries from, but they're looking for a cheap price. And the scale and the business model that Costco has allow them to price cheaper and earn very favorable economics despite those low prices that they charge. So if you look at these businesses, they tend to not get to a high return structure through margins, but through asset turnover. So a high volume of sales on an asset base. And again, consistent with what you see with economies of scale and economies of scope businesses.
Right.
The last one is a network advantage. So a network advantage occurs when all parties on the network derive value from growing scale of the network. So you can think about this like Visa or MasterCard, where if I'm the only one with a credit card from a credit card company and there's only one merchant in the world that has a terminal, that's not worth very much to me, and it's not worth very much to the merchant. Mm-hmm. However, as that network scales and you have millions and millions of merchants on the network, and also millions and millions of people with the Visa or MasterCard credit card that work on that network, that becomes a very difficult thing to challenge for a new entrant. And that happens because existing members of the network have very little incentive to go seek out an alternative network really at any cost. So what you find with network advantage businesses is if you see a first mover and they get there and they get there first and everyone on the network is happy, it becomes very difficult to displace them because there's right. just very little incentive for members to leave the network.
Gotcha. Great. Thank you. I mean, that was a lot of interesting detail, a lot of interesting examples there. A couple more questions here. And, you know, your last answer kind of prompted me to think of this one, that idea of competitive advantage, and then also the idea of kind of trying to find the best ideas at any given time. And really, that is kind of time dependent, I think. You think about the bizarre environment of 2020 with the COVID lockdowns and how a big part of the stock market just got hammered if you were a business that was dependent on, you know, social gathering. So you think about traditional retail, travel, restaurants. I mean, we all remember. And then on the flip side, you had a monster stocks that benefited from the need for virtual empowerment like Zoom and Roku, Chewy, Amazon. And you guys kind of leaned into that trend and it paid off well. Not saying it was those exact stocks necessarily, just the broader trend. And then you had the reopening trade of 2021 where value and cyclicals kind of ripped off the bottom and tech sold off, you know, pretty harshly. Then you had 2022 and just a brutal year for risk assets overall. And then last year, a market dominated by a handful of tech stocks. So after all that, my question then is after that kind of journey down memory lane is how do you balance finding the best of the best companies but then also adapting to changing market environment?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I mean, you mentioned the concept of time dependence, and there's some time dependence to competitive advantage. And you know, Warren Buffett is famous for going around the office asking his people, "Are company's moats wider or narrower today?" So it does change over time. I wouldn't say that's what drives most of the change in the portfolio. So in addition to one of three forms of competitive advantage, we're looking for three sources of total return to put together a reasonable total return prospect for our investors. So we operate on a 24-month time horizon, and the three sources of total return are your earnings growth, the multiple re-rating or de-rating, so the multiple change that you put on that stream of earnings, and your dividend income. And those are the three ways to get to a total return as we look at a stock. So, and that is certainly very time dependent, and it depends on how a business is valued. It depends on how we're seeing the growth profile of the business in the coming years. And it depends on elements to the investment thesis, which can serve to raise or lower the PE multiple on a business. Three sources of competitive advantage. The next step is three sources of total return, and what do they stack up to? And that's really what drives the change in the portfolio for the most part over time.
Right. Okay. So one last question for you, and this is really just to get your pulse on why buy equities now? Now, I know an equity PM is often going to say it's a great time to buy equities, but it is still, I think, very surprising to me at least, how averse investors still are to equities right now. You know, after the big drawdown in 2022, you saw, you know, you talked about re-rating, a big re-rating of risk over a couple year period because of inflation. But you think about just the amount of cash on the sidelines, you know, the $23 trillion and the big outflows in equity funds for many years now is kind of surprising. And I guess maybe even a little concerning, given the need that many people have and institutions have for equity returns to reach their long-term goals. So, I guess I just ask you, how do you, as a global investor, think about the world of equities now from a kind of a risk-reward standpoint?
As I said in the onset of the conversation, we're constructive on equities, and I think what belies that confidence is the outlook for corporate earnings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the near term, we have a lot of people who are debating, does the Fed hold? Do they cut once? Do they cut three times? I think the thing to keep your eye on is just the underlying strength of the economy. And unless that Fed policy upsets the apple cart in terms of the outlook for corporate earnings, equities should continue to do well. Valuations have gotten high in parts of the market, but there are certain parts of the market where you have a meaningful rebound in earnings still ahead of you, and that's areas like small caps. The data seems to be getting decidedly better in Europe. So there's a lot to be constructive on out there, and I would just take a step back and think about the outlook for corporate earnings, which looks very constructive from here.
All right, good stuff. So with that, I think we can wrap things up. And I'll just say thank you, Ryan, for joining the podcast. Some really interesting insights on global equity investing and what's likely to drive investment returns in the coming years. Definitely look forward to having you back later this year to check in.
Thank you, Brian. That would be great. I would love that.
Awesome. Thanks again, Ryan. And for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbott's views on the markets, please visit the insights section of lordabbott.com. We actually have a newly published article on global equity investing that touches on a lot of what Ryan and I discussed here today. And lastly, we'd also like to hear from our listeners. So if you have any comments about today's podcast or ideas for future podcasts, we welcome your thoughts and email podcasts@lordabbott.com. And so we'll leave it there. I'm Brian Forster. This has been the Active Investor Podcast. Thank you for listening.
Reference to level of cash held by U.S. investors is based on data from the Investment Company Institute, U.S. Federal Reserve, and Bloomberg, and is as of March 31, 2024. Data for portfolio company revenue by geographic region is derived from Lord Abbott analysis of company financial statements. Data for Nintendo Switch user base is from Nintendo as of December 31, 2023. Bottom-up investing is an investment approach that focuses on analyzing individual stocks and de-emphasizes the significance of macroeconomic and market cycles. Top-down investing takes the opposite approach, focusing on the macro factors of the economy and how they may influence the investment case for a particular security. CDs refer to certificates of deposit. Cash flow is the amount of cash or cash equivalent which the company receives or gives out by the way of payments to creditors. Cyclical stocks represent companies that make or sell discretionary items and services that are in demand when the economy is doing well. A drawdown is an investment term that refers to the decline in value of a single investment or an investment portfolio from a relative peak value to a relative low point. Duopoly refers to a situation in which two companies together control all, or nearly all, of the market for a given product or service. An entrenched business is characterized by well-established product or service offerings and market positioning. Growth value investing. Growth stocks are companies that investors expect will grow much faster than others. These companies are relatively new, or in rapidly growing industries, such as technology. Investors seek growth stocks for their future earnings prospects as compared to their industry and the overall market. Value investors are interested in stocks that appear to be undervalued. Value stocks may have some of the following characteristics, as compared to a market index: lower price/earnings or PE ratio, lower price to cash flow ratio, lower price to book or PB ratio, and a higher dividend yield. Indexing is a form of passive fund management in which the fund manager builds a portfolio that aims to mirror the securities of a particular index. Macroeconomics is a branch of economics that studies the behavior of an overall economy, which encompasses markets, businesses, consumers, and governments. Microeconomics is the study of individuals' and businesses' decisions and their effect on an economy's performance. Market capitalization. The U.S. Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or FINRA, defines the following categories of stocks based on their market value: mega-cap stocks, $200 billion or more; large-cap stocks, between $10 billion and $200 billion; mid-cap stocks, between $2 billion and $10 billion; small-cap stocks, between $250 million and $2 billion; and micro-cap stocks, less than $250 million. Monetary policy is a set of actions, generally taken by central banks, to control a nation's overall money supply and achieve economic growth. Price-to-earnings ratio. Stock analysts calculate a price-to-earnings ratio, or P/E multiple, by dividing a stock's current price by its earnings per share on a trailing 12-month basis. A forward price-to-earnings ratio is calculated by dividing a stock's current price by estimated future earnings per share. Multiple re-rating refers to changes in how investors and analysts value stocks based on variations in P/E ratios over time. Return on invested capital, or ROIC, is calculated by dividing a company's net operating profit after tax by invested capital. ROIC gives a sense of how well a company is using its capital to generate profits. The U.S. Federal Reserve, or Fed, is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, or Fed funds rate, is the target interest rate set by the Fed at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight. The credit quality of fixed income securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, or NSRO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, highest, to D, lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings, BB and below, are lower rated securities or junk bonds. Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to securities of those companies. Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. Certain information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources, and such information has not been independently verified by Lord Abbott. No representation, warranty, or undertaking, expressed or implied, is given to the accuracy or completeness of such information by Lord Abbott or any other person. While such sources are believed to be reliable, Lord Abbott does not assume any responsibility for the accuracy or completeness of such information. Lord Abbott does not undertake any obligation to update the information contained herein as of any future date. Certain information contained herein constitutes forward-looking statements, which can be identified by the use of forward-looking terminology such as may, will, should, expect, anticipate, project, estimate, intend, continue, or believe, or the negatives thereof or other variations thereon or comparable terminology. Due to various risks and uncertainties, actual events, results, or actual performance may differ materially from those reflected or contemplated in such forward-looking statements. Nothing contained herein may be relied upon as a guarantee, promise, assurance, or a representation as to the future. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbot Speaker are those of the Speaker as of the date of the broadcast, and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market or other conditions, and Lord Abbot disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbot nor the Lord Abbot Speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in, or refrain from, any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbot nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. This broadcast is the copyright 2024 of Lord Abbot & Co. LLC, all rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part, or any form without the permission of Lord Abbot. Lord Abbot Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbot Distributor LLC.